This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. A bill is making its way through the North Carolina legislature that would assure fair treatment for all college students, regardless of their ideology. Well, that sounds good, and it sounds like something that should already be happening. But conservative students and some off-campus organizations say that is not the case. They claim liberal-leaning faculty creates an atmosphere that can be hostile to their views. The bill coincides with the release of a new study that claims 72% of college faculty are liberal. The number is even higher, 87%, at so-called elite schools. So is an academic bill of rights a good idea or a bad one? And perhaps more importantly, what is the environment on college campuses? Is the debate robust enough? Are both sides, or all sides, getting a fair hearing? Give us a call at 877-962-9862. We're joined by two faculty members. Mike Munger chairs the Political Science Department at Duke University. Hello, Mike.
It's great to be on the show, Frank.
And Judith Wenger is with us, professor of law and chair of the faculty at UNC Chapel Hill. Judith, welcome.
Thank you, Frank.
Mike Munger, let me start with you, because the bill was written by David Horowitz. It's being published by a group called Students for Academic Freedom. You're the faculty advisor at Duke for Students for Academic Freedom, but you don't think this bill's a good idea. Why is that?
Well, I think things on some campuses, there may be problems, but they're not nearly so bad that the legislature can't make them worse. This is an internal matter of policy for the faculty, and I think it's an educational matter. It's not a question of rights. This is not a First Amendment issue. It says Congress shall make no law. So deciding how that we're going to conduct the business of education is something the faculty have to take charge of, and the legislature should stay out.
Judith Wenger?
Yes, I think Mike's absolutely right on that. I think that really, in terms of what such a bill may do, it seems to me that there's a lot of questions in my mind whether those who are supporting it really understand the nature of education and the need to help students develop critical thinking with the faculty working collectively to be sure that the curriculum is sound and that educational methods are sound. And I think that the bill assumes that there's problems that in my experience really don't exist. Plus, I think it really would make things further politicize or try to make into legal issues things that are at core about educators' professional judgment.
Well, Judith Wenger, let's talk a little bit more about that and talk about the what's at the core of this issue rather than the bill itself. There is a sense that with self-professed polls anyway, showing that professors are, you know, three-quarters of them declare themselves as liberals, that it's pretty hard for conservatives to get a fair hearing and for conservative ideas to get a fair hearing. Do you think that's the case on campuses?
Well, I really think that by and large, people's political views, how they vote and that kind of thing are irrelevant to, I mean, do you think, or would somebody argue that a professor teaching physics or something like that, that how they vote is likely to be germane to how they approach their teaching?
Not how they vote, but I think the argument is that the thrust of their research might keep them from getting a job if it didn't align itself with progressive ideas.
Getting a job, I've never, ever heard of occasions that anybody would inquire about somebody's political affiliation in connection with hiring or promotion or things of that sort. And I just think that that's assuming facts that are incorrect.
Mike Munger?
Well, it seems to me if you flip a coin 50 times and it comes up heads 45, it's not a fair coin. There's something about the process that is disproportionately choosing people who are of liberal persuasion. A lot of faculty think that diversity means that we should range from the left to the far left. I was at a meeting not that long ago where a chair of another department said that she really thought that her primary job was to confront conservatives with their hypocrisies. Liberal students she didn't need to talk so much about. So to me, I guess I would state the problem a little bit differently. It seems to me the problem is that liberal students are not playing against the first team. Conservative students are a bunch of whiners. It reminds me of the scene from Monty Python where they say, "Help, help, I'm being oppressed. Witness the violence inherent in the system." The fact is they're playing against the first team. They're taken seriously. I don't think that I agree with Judith. I don't think there's many open instances of oppression. What happens, though, is that liberal students don't get argued with. And the best faculty do it. There are plenty of good faculty that can argue either side, but there are many faculty that think their own views are scientific, and anyone who disagrees with them is not a scientist. So I've heard people say that asking the history department to hire a conservative is like asking the biology department to hire a creationist.
Judith?
Well, I don't think that we'd be seeing anything of that sort going on. I mean, I think more, and it may be, Mike, in connection with political science departments, it seems to me that since political science departments, and as you know, since you were here at Carolina and now at Duke, that they may be known for divisions of view about particular topics, how, and often in my mind, it's more about debates of which camp within the academy or what type of research or something like that. Those tend to be the more edgy kinds of debates, I think, within some of the social sciences. Here, for example, there was a time when people started to develop use of oral history as an approach to historical studies, and to introduce a new methodology for research or focus in that way, that may run up against what I would describe as conservative, not from a political viewpoint, but conservative in terms of expectations or what the standard assumptions are about nature of research or focus of courses. But I think that the way that universities typically work is there will be subsequent generations learning, coming to bear, their thinking to bear on maybe even the same questions, but they may come at it differently. So I think often if there's that kind of a seeming chasm, in my mind it would tend to be related to the subdivisions of thought within a given discipline.
What about Mike's point that, you know, you don't really get a good argument if all of your professors agree with you politically? For the liberal students, they're being shortchanged.
Well, again, I guess I'd question the assumption. I really don't think, first of all, I question the sense of there's a liberal view and there's a conservative view, because on most things, I mean, we well know if we are attentive to the political realm these days, you know, what is a fiscal conservative in terms of having balanced budgets? I don't know. Is that liberal, conservative, whatever?
It's apparently not a Republican.
Pardon me?
It's apparently not a Republican.
Well, if that is an observation from you, you didn't get it from me, because if that's a political view, I don't do that. Well, I teach, I think that to say that liberal students aren't getting pushed by professors, I think that's just really mistaken, because most of what people are talking about is how to think thoughtfully, analytically, and in ways that really press assumptions, pre-existing assumptions, on very difficult questions. If you have, for example, people working on public policy matters, I don't think that typically there's a litmus test that says this is liberal, this is conservative. And I think, frankly, there's probably two ways professors in an area like that can approach their teaching philosophy. One can be that they put on the table going in that their view is thus and such, so there's not hod the ball about it, but that they conscientiously encourage students to disagree with them, and that they will challenge all comers one way or the other on that. And if students are uneasy about that, I know some people who may have what one might think is a non-traditional viewpoint, just to put it that way, and some of them will assign as a topic for a paper that students find what's wrong with their approach to things and find better authority that competes with their view. So
well,
I think
let's go to the phones just for a moment, because I know we've got some callers. Marshall is on the line from Durham. Hello, Marshall.
Hi, good afternoon.
You have a question for us?
Well, I've got two points I want to make. The first is, I'm a professor of law at North Carolina Central University. I'm an unabashed liberal, and I've spent the last 3 days taking the conservative side of the Establishment Clause on religion, because my class is so overwhelmingly progressive on the issue that I want to push their thinking and challenge their thinking. And that's what all good professors do, and I think it's probably really wrong to think that it happens very often that professors don't do that. I think professors do work very hard at challenging their students, whether their students are conservative or whether their students are liberal. The second point I'd like to make has to do with the numbers And whether or not it has anything to do with anything, the fact that there are a lot of liberals in academia. Maybe we ought to be concerned that there are 78% of CEOs of the Fortune 500 are conservative, and we really need to sweep them out and have more liberals that are running Fortune 500 companies. It's certainly not the case that we need to have equilibrium in every aspect of life. Perhaps liberals don't want to be Fortune 500 CEOs. Perhaps Fortune 500 CEOs don't want to teach in colleges and universities. To think that there needs to be some sort of equilibrium among the political perspective in every aspect and every walk of life is ridiculous.
All right. Well, thank you for your call, and we will talk more about that. And I guess ask the question, if that's really the proportion, as Marshall just suggested, you know, where are the conservatives? Why are they not making their way to the halls of America's colleges and universities? On the State of Things, talking about the proposal for an academic bill of rights with Mike Munger, chair of the Political Science Department at Duke University, and Judith Wegner, professor of law and chair of the faculty at UNC Chapel Hill. Taking your calls at 877-962-9862. Is there a fair hearing for conservative viewpoints on American college campuses? Later in the program, an acclaimed cook needs some biscuit help. If you know a secret to making a perfect biscuit, well, our food maven Kelly Alexander could use your help.
And I am forming the National Association for the Advancement of the Society of Hand-Squished Biscuit.
Stand by with your best biscuit tips after we finish our chat about academic freedom. Support for the State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners who support North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. We are joined in the studio by Mike Munger, political science chair at Duke University, and Judith Wegner, faculty chair at UNC Chapel Hill, talking today about a proposed academic bill of rights. Proponents of the bill say it protects students and professors from discrimination by removing partisan politics from the classroom. Good idea. We're taking your calls at 877-962-9862. Mike Munger, before the break, we heard from a professor who said good professors always challenge their students to think and think critically, whatever their political persuasion. That's your experience?
Well, I think good ones do. There may not be quite as many good ones as we would like to think. Marshall, the caller, and Professor Wegner both are at law schools. And Judith before had made an argument about political science exceptionalism. I think that's wrong. I think there's law school exceptionalism. They learn how to make arguments. They're teaching advocacy. It's really only in law schools that you can be sure that they're going to try to argue both sides. I think in most of the social sciences that isn't true. The Brown University, for the last 2 years, has flown me up in the fall. They have kind of a rent-a-conservative program. They have so few conservatives on the faculty. I gave a talk. It was Friday night at 9 o'clock. There's 300 kids in the audience. And afterwards, they came up and said, you know, that was about the biggest load of garbage we ever heard. We completely disagree with you, and it's so fantastic. I've been at Brown 3 years, and I've never heard a professor say something I disagreed with. It's so refreshing to hear an alternative point of view.
Mike, this could be a new career for you. You could be on the road all the time.
Munger over America.
What were you talking about, Mike?
Well, the challenge was about democracy and institutions. They tend to think that democracy is just something that they should accept, and this is a claim I think most thoughtful people would believe, that constitutional protections of individual rights are at least as important as the ability of the majority to impose its will. So it wasn't anything very controversial.
Judith Wegner, I wonder if we could, I could pose this scenario to you. Do you think a professor who had done a great deal of research that, according to their research, demonstrates that the nuclear family is the best way for women to protect themselves against abuse and that they wanted to become a faculty member of a women's studies department would have a prayer of getting a job if their research supported the idea of the nuclear family as a very good way to protect women? Could they get a job?
Well, I would have to say that people should be thinking about the quality of the research. And when you say that they had done good research, I think it really would depend upon that. I was interested, for example, in this past weekend's New York Times, the feature story about the professor at Harvard who was looking at race in fresh ways. That really were not the conventional kinds of things that have been done before, because people may have been afraid to ask difficult questions about race, and he happened to be African American, so that opened the door for him in some ways that might not otherwise have been there. He's an economist. I think for the fact pattern you present, I'd want to know really the nature of the research. I don't think that people should be disqualified if they've done good work that is well-grounded, professionally sound, solid, and pushing the envelope, and I think most people would, in fact, want to give that a fair hearing. I don't know what the field that person would be in or how that would relate to what their prior work or background would be, but I would hope that that's not something categorically put out of mind.
All right, let's go to the phones again. Kelly is on the line from Durham. Hello, Kelly.
Hi, how are you?
Good. You have a comment for us or
well,
question?
Yeah, I mean, I'm actually very interested in this whole conversation. I have done adjunct teaching at Duke in the Department of Religion. And one of the things that has been my experience in the classroom that when issues are brought up that I know that there are conservative opinions on, the students very seldom, the conservative students very seldom actually put forward those positions. So my experience has not been that they're being silenced in the classroom. It's been that they're being irresponsible about putting forward their positions, which, like the guy from Central was saying, then leaves me in the position of putting forward and articulating and defending those arguments so that they have a place in the discussion at all.
Well, irresponsible, or do they feel intimidated?
I don't think they feel intimidated because, you know, I see the, you know, I see the comments on discussion boards, you know, and in other forums in the class, but they don't come up in the class discussion.
Mike Munger?
I think they say they feel intimidated. Students have a responsibility to try to make the arguments that they're interested in. I encountered a student who said she didn't respect conservatives and thought they weren't very bright. And I asked her, well, what conservative faculty do you have in mind? And she says, well, I've never had a conservative faculty member. It's just the other students. And then she reminisced and said, one day we were talking about abortion, and the professor noticed that there were no students who were pro-life. And the professor decided to make pro-life arguments. He did a great job doing it. So a good professor can take that role, it's true. But then she said, and I didn't even know why he was wrong.
So, well, you don't have to be persuaded in the first class. Now. Kelly, thank you very much for your call. I guess the other question is, if three-quarters of the college professors are conservative or liberal, and the nation is firmly in the hands of conservative politicians, the real question is, why are they such lousy teachers? I wonder if, but the other question is, why are there so few? And that is a serious question. Judith, why do you suppose the numbers are what they are? And these are self-described, I understand.
Well, yes, and I tried to dig out that study that you mentioned by Rothman and Lichter. I don't know, you know, their methodology or how to critique it. I haven't had time, frankly, because I didn't expect to be talking to you today to really take it apart. But I think, first of all, what it means to describe oneself one way or another since, I think, 1999 makes me wonder, you know, what right. Implications there would be in light of the complexity of how one positions oneself on the political spectrum. In addition, I think I would say, picking up on something that Mike said, I don't know, in a sense, why people want to choose the line of career that they do, but I think these days, I'd say the conservative students are in the substantial majority that when they graduate from college, if conservatism, however one defines that, maps against value set that involves kind of a certain amount of libertarian, I want to advance my individual career kind of thing, they may be going into other fields rather than staying in an academic graduate program kind of trajectory. I suspect, too, that if one looked at different disciplines, say business schools, economics, maybe some of the sciences, engineering, that you might see a higher incidence of people who would be inclined to follow those paths if they do graduate school. And it may be in some of those fields there's much better paying work outside the academy. So I think that that's a sufficiently complicated question that you can't assume that there's some broad brush here. I think, too, that how one imagines political spectrum where you go. I mean, I think people would say about law professors, for example, most people coming into the law professoriate could be making a whole lot more money if they were in law firms, and it may be a liberal value to not to put money as the highest value.
Well, Mike Munger, why do you think that those numbers are what they are?
Well, a lot of it is the choices that people make. I actually do think, though, that many people who take a conservative perspective are treated as not intellectually respectable. And so the analogy that I made about the biology department being forced to hire creationists is the one that I would stick with. The question is, what would the solution be? And I think that almost all of the solutions are worse than the problem. What we need to do is remember that our duty as educators is to present both sides of the question. That's just what good teaching is. And if we come back to that rather than indoctrination, I think the problem will solve itself. It's self-correcting.
Yeah, but again, we're still talking about the classroom, and it doesn't talk about the body of research. I get back to my example. If you came up and there were three qualified candidates and you came to a women's studies program for a job and you had research that didn't support the trend in women's studies or even in history, if we were taking, again, an unpopular view or an unprogressive view, would you get the job?
I actually agree with the claims that were made before, some about by Marshall and some by Kelly, the callers. It seems to me that the academy answers some of the things that are going on in the larger society. And it's true, you can pick on the programs that end with studies, African-American studies, women's studies. They're an answer to something that's going on in the larger society where there's a lot of conservative thought.
All right. Well, I want to thank you both. Mike Munger, chair of the Political Science Department at Duke University, and Judith Wegner, professor of law and chair of the faculty at UNC Chapel Hill. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Comedian Jerry Clower confirming what most of us already know, biscuits is good eating. And with that in mind, our favorite foodie Kelly Alexander is back with a confession to make. Kelly is famous for her croquembouche, which is easier to say, make probably, than it is to say or spell. But it is among the most difficult desserts, in fact, to make. Yet Kelly cannot, no matter how hard she tries, cannot make a biscuit. So we're going to try to help you today. Give us a call at 877-962-9862 if you think you've got a biscuit recipe that can help Kelly. But Kelly, first of all, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Hi, Frank.
What is it with biscuits?
That's the question, isn't it? It's psychological. For all of the things and for all of the years that I've cooked, and I've gone to French cooking classes, and I'm a food writer and editor, I can't make a good biscuit. And I'm outing myself. I need some help.
But you're a Southern girl.
I am a Southern girl, and I love biscuits, and that's the root of the problem.
Do you think it's like just some kind of panic?
I think it's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy. My first few times of making biscuits were disastrous, and then I got it into my head that making biscuits was more difficult than it was, and yeah. Now, 13 years later, I still can't make one.
Because I have to say, I cook, and I'm sort of the primary cook in our family. Most would agree. Most in the family would agree with that. And yet, there's no way on the planet that I can make a good meatloaf. And there, my wife, Joanne, is first rate. Her meatloaf is just, it's right there.
What's
going on?
Is it the phenomenon, I think, is the same? It's that sometimes the stakes are very high for you personally in a way that you can't explain to other people. I happen to really love biscuits, and I went into my first biscuit making kind of cavalierly. I thought I would just be able to quickly put them together, and that was the first problem. I couldn't, and then it became kind of a stumbling block for me.
Well, do you try too hard? I mean, if you're doing complicated things, then you end up trying. You say, well, it can't be that easy. Maybe just a little more, you know.
Maybe a little more water, a little more buttermilk.
Yeah. Right. That's what. But what makes, I mean, a good biscuit needs to be, obviously, it's got to be light, but it's got to have, you know, got to rise.
Exactly. It's got to rise. I like biscuits to be really, really light and have layers and sort of crumble apart and yet hold together. You know, there's a really great biscuit should melt in your mouth but be solid enough so that you can actually cut it without it, you know, devolving into a series of crumbs. But right. That's a hard thing to do. It's a real textural issue, and I think that there's some kind of disconnect between my brain and my hands when I make biscuits.
So you should know going in, because it's everything. It's not just the ingredients and how you put it together. It's also the bacon or the frying or however you're going to make them.
Exactly. The easiest thing about biscuits is the formula, right? It's right. Flour, butter, some buttermilk. You maybe could use water instead. That part's easy. The hard part to me is the technical part. It's the handling of the dough, and that's where I think it all breaks down.
So there's got to be some muscle memory and some feel that you just either are you're born with or you're not.
I think you have to have a really light touch.
I see. And you failed every way. I mean, you failed
yes.
at every stage, right?
Yes, I have.
Tell us about how these have come out in ungood ways.
Well, in the course of my biscuit making, I'm always looking for the easy answer at this point. You know, I just want to try and find the final piece of the puzzle. So I'll try anything. I'll make them in a cast iron skillet. Mm-hmm. I will try making them with water, with more flour, with less. And so I've had gummy biscuits. I've had biscuits that never rose. I've had biscuits that were like sort of little lead bombs. I mean, I've had a lot of disasters.
All right. Well, we're trying to get you some help at 877-962-9862. Here's our first attempt at triage with Steve from Greensboro. Steve, you have a tip for us?
Sure.
First of all, welcome.
I'll make it short and simple. I'm born and bred in the north, and my wife is born and bred in the south, and she lets me make the biscuits at home most of the time. Kelly, just buy a box of Bisquick. You can't go wrong.
That's not bad advice. I don't mind Bisquick, but I have a real desire to make them homemade myself since I haven't been able to yet. So I'm still working on it. I haven't totally given myself over to Bisquick yet.
And there's no real secret there. I mean, it's just got baking soda and baking powder, right? I mean,
absolutely.
You should be able to break this down. So what's a good, now, in terms of, not commercial, but have you found a good biscuit in Chapel Hill and this
actually,
area?
Actually, I moved to Chapel Hill on Labor Day of last year, and I found my favorite biscuit ever, much to my surprise. There is a place on Franklin Street called the Sunrise Biscuit Kitchen, and I think it's really close to heaven. Those biscuits, to be honest with you, are a little bigger than I would have thought I would like. They're almost the size of hamburgers, but they are so perfect. They're just the best biscuits I've ever tasted.
Well, that's because you got to get the egg and the sausage and the yellow, I think it's cheese on there. Yeah.
I even like them plain. I just think they're perfect.
All right. Well, let's see if we can get you some more help now. Stan is on the line from Durham. Hello, Stan. Stan, are you there? Yeah. Hello, Stan.
Yeah, hey.
Good. You got some biscuit help for us?
Well, yes, nothing too technical. However, the way I learned how to do biscuits after many a failed batch is I took a rainy Sunday afternoon. I made about 10 batches in a row.
Really? And that worked out for you?
It worked out great for me. I just would dump a whole bunch of them in the trash can and then would start over with my next batch.
So it's persistence. And it really doesn't take that long, does it? Thank you very much, Dan. I mean, to put a batch together.
No, it does not take very long.
What about some of the fancy ones? I mean, you see sweet potato biscuits, and I mean, you ever try to kind of go gourmet with biscuits? You just want to get the basic biscuit
down. I feel that way about biscuits the way I feel about creme brulee. You know, you can see that dessert all over menus now, and there's raspberry creme brulee and espresso creme brulee, and I don't like it like that. I just like the genuine article. I don't want sweet potato biscuits.
I'm thinking butterscotch chips would be the kind of, that's what I'm waiting for. Okay, Jimmy, you have some for us?
Yes, let me turn my radio down. I come from a long line of really good biscuit cooks, and I've only actually made them once in my life, but I took the advice from my aunt that made the best biscuits, and my biscuits came out just like hers, but I've just been too lazy to make them. But I can tell you, don't overwork the dough. Whatever shortening you use, you should still have lumps in it. Overworking the dough ruins the biscuits.
I think you're absolutely right, and I think that you have hit on my problem. I get real nervous that I'm not combining properly, you know, with the dough and the shortening, and I kind of go to town.
Just work it too hard. Thank you very much. Have you noticed, Kelly, that all of our callers have been men?
Our male. Yes, I have.
The guys, and that's the pain for you is that you think that if you can eat it and you love it, you ought to be able to make it.
Absolutely. I think that there's such an innate pleasure in being able to cook for yourself something that you love to eat. Nothing can taste better than and more satisfying than a meal that you made yourself that turns out well.
I'm just guessing that the guys who've called in are biscuit eaters, too.
Absolutely.
And they've decided the only way they're going to get a good one is to make it themselves. All right. Oh, Nick, look at this. Nick, you have a tip for us?
Yes, Kelly, I think I have the solution to your problem.
Well, tell me.
If you have dough handling problems, there are some experts in the area that you can actually watch for free.
Okay, tell me about it.
In Durham, on 15501, actually just across the street from where I am right now, is Biscuitville, which is, in my humble biscuit opinion, far better biscuits than Sunrise. Although
you think?
I do like Sunrise. Yeah, absolutely.
I like Biscuitville, too, but go ahead.
And in Biscuitville, they have a big glass window where you stand in line. You can watch these old ladies, usually they're old ladies, make their biscuits right there on the counter in front of you.
Well,
you watch them knead the dough. You watch them combine. You watch them cut.
I'll tell you, Nick, I need more therapy than that. I want to be invited behind the glass with the ladies. I want them to actually stand behind me and hold my hands. But that's good advice.
Thank you very much, Nick. See, we're getting plenty of good advice here. We can do the biscuit tour of the Triangle.
I don't think that's a bad idea
at all.
Move
up to the Triad. We can do the biscuit tour of North Carolina. But you will keep trying.
I will.
And when you come up with the best biscuit, you're going to come back and bring them. And then we'll have the Biscuit Fest right here. Well, thank you very much. Kelly Alexander, food writer and a cook, senior contributing editor to Savour Magazine.
Thanks, Frank.
Thank you. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. In 1898, two men, John Merrick and Dr. Aaron Moore, founded the North Carolina Mutual Life Insurance Company in Durham. The company would soon become the cornerstone of the African-American business community known as Black Wall Street. North Carolina Mutual grew to become the nation's largest black-owned business under the leadership of C.C. Spaulding and is still the largest black-managed insurance company in the country. A year and a half ago, North Carolina Mutual began the process of organizing its archives. Archivist Ray Christian joins us now to talk about what he's finding. Ray, hello.
Hello.
Also joining us is Chuck Watts. He's a corporate secretary and general counsel at North Carolina Mutual and great-grandson of one of the founders of the company. Chuck, thanks for being here.
Hi, Frank. How are you?
Good. Chuck, let me start with you. It was your idea to start the archive. What's behind that?
First of all, the company's history is simply, I think, unique in many respects. And as a result, I thought it was something that we should, at a minimum, retain and protect and organize. And that was our first objective in putting together the archives. You know, certainly for me, actually, both of the men you identified are my great-grandparents on my mother's side. And so for me, there was a personal sort of family interest. But the truth is that North Carolina Mutual has a lot of family stories that are interesting and part of really the American history that you don't hear about.
Ray, when we talk about an archive now, what kind of material are you finding and where is it? How has it been saved so far?
I would say the materials in various formats, from films, manuscripts, tapes, books, publications, both internal and external, newspapers from the period. A lot of different materials.
Tell us about John Merrick and Aaron Moore.
Two interesting men, but I have to say that at the beginning of the company, there was actually seven founders that we refer to Merrick and Moore as the founders because there came a time in the company's early period, first few years, that there was a rather large claim that came into the company, and these men were willing to reach into their pockets in order to make sure that the funds were there to cover it. Aaron McDuffie Moore was a physician who was trained at the Shaw Leonard Medical School and had an interesting career. And both Merrick, however, was a barber and had become quite successful as a barber in both Raleigh and Durham. I think he had about five different barbershops. And they came together as entrepreneurs and really started or participated in the starting of most of the black institutions that exist in Durham. Everything from what's now North Carolina Central University to Mechanics and Farmers Bank, a number of organizations. So,
how difficult was it to start a business in Durham for African Americans in 1898?
Well, when you ask a question like that, the answer is always a relative answer. One has to understand the context of Durham. Durham was a new city. It really hadn't existed prior to the Civil War. You had the development of the Duke family switching from doing simply raising tobacco to manufacturing tobacco. So you had, it became a manufacturing city. And in many respects, Durham is thought of as kind of a gritty town. And that's why it didn't have an established sort of blue blood or upper class and old businesses. I mean, everything that started in Durham, I guess in about 1865 or so, when the town was sort of started, there was maybe 3,000 to 5,000 people there. By the turn of the century, there was maybe 25,000 to 30,000 people there. So in that kind of a growth, I would suggest that starting a business was pretty normal.
Was there anything about Durham that made it easier to start and maintain and sustain a business in Durham than other southern cities?
I think something about the fact that it was started kind of at the boom, you know, at one time. I actually heard a lecture one time from a historian that was talking about the history of San Francisco, and obviously it's a bigger town, but he talked about the fact that San Francisco, because of the gold rush, was a place where you had people from all over the world coming in at one time, rather than what he described in New York, and you might see it played out kind of gangs in New York movie, as the layered immigration, which creates, you know, sort of existing hierarchies and status quos, and then new groups coming in, challenging that status quo layer and layer. Well, Durham more was reflected in the San Francisco model, and I think because of that, it was unique. It is true, you mentioned the Black Wall Street term. It is true that there were other cities in the South and in the Midwest that were characterized as Black Wall Streets at one time or another, but almost every last one of those was ultimately torn asunder by, you know, in a fit of racial strife. So, you know, you've had other examples. Tulsa is the one that comes to my mind the most, and I've heard John Hope Franklin talk about that. He was actually from Tulsa and was around when it was destroyed. But you had that example in other cities.
Things that did not happen in Durham, happened in other places.
What happened in Wilmington around the same period of time.
Right.
And so it's just interesting that it didn't happen in Durham. So I would characterize that as being something unique about Durham.
Well, Ray, are you finding anything in this archive material that sheds light on that?
Well, certainly the documentary evidence supports everything that Chuck just said. We did a worldwide search of all the publications that we have in the archive, and out of 23 separate publications, at least 20 of them exist nowhere else in the world except in our archives. The company subscribed to all the Black newspapers, regional magazines, trade publications, and business publications in that era, and we have collections of nearly all of them.
I suspect that sheds light on the period, more than just the company, the whole era then.
Cultural history.
Yeah. Well, what are you finding? Anything surprising so far in what you found?
I think the most unique item that we have in the collection would be a 1831 insurance policy that was issued to a North Carolina mutual insurance company, but it's not us. And that company, well, here's the irony, that company actually sold slave insurance.
Well, and were they in business when?
Not simultaneously, no.
Wow. Then this was an 1831 claim.
1831.
So somebody shows up with that, knocks on the door and says, oops.
Well, no, actually what happened was much later. Found by someone.
Someone from the Baltimore life insurance company actually sent it to us.
I see.
In 1969. So that's the connection.
And that's how you found this
They
thing.
Thought it was the same company.
Right.
I took one look at it and said, either my history's off or something's wrong here.
Yeah.
Where did this come from?
Tell us a little bit about that, what that was like, and especially in the early days. You've got agents who are, I guess, going to rural areas selling insurance. What were the products? And give us a sense of what it was like back then.
One of the things that needs to be understood is that North Carolina Mutual was not the first historically Black life insurance company. There had been others, and in fact, there had been other large ones. And one, in fact, out of Richmond, Virginia, Mr. Merrick had been an agent for. And so he understood something about insurance from that experience. But in every state, pretty much, you had the situation where people came together to try to sort of retain dignity at the point of someone's passing. The major companies had taken the position that Black folks, while they had survived slavery, were a dubious bet in a free environment, which is kind of ironic. But and so it was left to Black folks to provide insurance to each other. And in general, most of them started with what was called mutual benefit societies, and that's the way North Carolina Mutual was originally founded. It wasn't set up as an insurance company in the sense that we have today with a reserve account to support the obligations. And that's why that situation came up with the rather large claim. And so you had people relying on paying into a pot and being able to reach into the pot at the point of someone's death. And so this was pretty much the need that was being served by most of these companies, and it was done, what today we call these sort of burial policies. But that was what was being provided.
Ordinarily, we wouldn't be talking about the importance of the history of an insurance company, but in this case, because of the cultural impact and the political impact that this company has had, it is significant. Tell us a little bit about that. What kind of impact has this company had, particularly in the early days?
I think for North Carolina Mutual, the uniqueness of a black company that used sound business practices and was also a pillar for its community is what has sort of fueled the company to be able to be around, particularly through the Depression era and so forth. Those challenges were real, and the reason why we are the oldest and the largest now is because of those business practices that were imposed.
And I've read that the impact of having insurance agents go into rural areas wearing suit and tie, gave a real sense of other possibilities, that black people could be professionals in professions other than what had been seen as traditional at the time.
Yes, that's definitely true. In fact, if you read Toni Morrison's work, her book Song of Solomon actually starts, the first line in the book starts off, the North Carolina Mutual Man. And what happens to him is not particularly great, but if you read Toni Morrison's books, you understand that. But it was, I think, the point that she was making and mentioning the company at that time was to reflect on the fact that it was the North Carolina Mutual Man, as he was described many times, was back in historical times, was a real pillar in the community and a reflection of what opportunity it was for black people.
And of course, it's more than just a symbol. You talked about the good business practices that have allowed the company to survive this long. One of the driving forces for almost 30 years was C.C. Spaulding, who, am I right, started as a part-time agent and then rose to president by 1923 and is credited with steering the company through the Depression. Tell us a little bit about C.C. Spaulding.
Well, I would have to say that he was more than a part-time agent to start with. He was brought in by Aaron McDuffie Moore to – Dr. Moore brought him in he was a cousin of his from down in Columbus County. He brought him in to work at the company. He and Merrick both had thriving businesses as apart from the insurance activity. And so C.C. Spaulding was actually the first full-time employee of the company. And the legend has it that he used to, sweep the floor and do the accounting and then sell a few insurance policies almost every day. And there's actually some pictures that support the fact that he was pretty much the engine behind the company, really following their leadership. And I think by the time he died, he was not only chief financial officer, not only the president of the company, but he was president of three other companies and chairman of the board at North Carolina Central and the hospital and various other places. So he was truly master of all he surveyed at the time of his death, and he was president from the early 20s up until till the early 50s.
Also involved in voter registration efforts?
He was one of the pillars behind the founding and starting of the Durham Committee on the Affairs of Black People, and of course we all know that organization has had an incredible history in terms of political movement in Durham, and yeah, he was involved in all that.
Ray Christian, are you finding anything in the archive material that could really inform the history of Durham, or that, in a sense, changes the history of Durham?
I don't know about changing the history, but maybe make that information more available. One example would be the company had a lot of internal publications, one in particular, the Whetstone. It started in 1924, and it ran to about 2000. And you see the development in the city. You see it through the change in the language, the very blunt way they spoke about the problems that were taking place during the Depression era, during World War II, and it gives you a totally different flavor.
So what were some of the surprises in
that? Well, certainly the language, the way some of these publications were written, the Victorian language that they used, and that continued right about into the 60s when you're seeing a little more moderation
Oh, that's when the PR guy showed up.
Right.
All right. In this archive material, so you're seeing these sort of memos passing back and forth and some of the conflicts that are going on. We talked about C.C. Spaulding being, you know, part of the voter registration drive. So the company's involved in social issues, political issues. But you also understand that in the 60s, there seemed to be, at least from what I've read, a withdrawal, wanting to stand back a little bit from direct political action. The story of Bill Clements and his trouble with the company, because they felt, according to what I've read, he was getting too involved in civil rights activities.
I would say the company was apolitical. It was a business. It ran like a business, consistent with what you'd probably find anywhere in America, any major American corporation.
In a sense, does that reflect what's happening? I mean, as things become more integrated, the company has to act more like an integrated company versus a black-owned company.
Well, I think there's something to what you're saying, but I think back in the 60s, the challenge was not so much that as it was, I'm not exactly sure, but my guess is that, you know, you're talking about a financial institution that has a lot of money paid, you know, invested in bonds and major institutions in America. Simultaneously, you have a group of young African-Americans running around talking about start the revolution. Mm-hmm. The two are not really congruous. Not that, you know, the company was at all opposed to efforts to try to seek freedom for black people, and I'm sure they were supportive of that in almost everything they did, and I'm sure during that time they were continuing to support the Durham Committee and so forth. But, you know, in the debate that went on between the Martins and the Martin Luther Kings and the Malcolm X's of the world, I'm sure there was a bit of consternation about where exactly did we come down on that, and what's in the interest of our policyholders, and how can we make sure that this institution is still here to pay these, you know, death policies 30 and 40 years from now.
So what do we plan to do with the archive? What form are we going to be able to visit this at some point? Will it be a public archive?
Well, our first objective is to collect and preserve the archive, and Ray Christian has been an outstanding resource in achieving that goal. We're pretty well along the way in doing that. We do have a heritage room on our 12th floor over at 411 West Chapel Hill Street, where you can come in and see the collection, not the whole collection, but a sampling of the collection. In the future, we do intend to provide it to academics. That's probably right around the corner to be able to do research and to have access to it. But we're hoping to even do more with it, maybe have a traveling exhibit and this sort of thing.
Thank you very much, Chuck. Chuck Watts is the Corporate Secretary and General Counsel at North Carolina Mutual, and Ray Christian is the archivist for North Carolina Mutual. Thank you both.
Thank you.
That's the state of things for today. Thanks for listening. If you have a comment, you can drop us an email here at sot@wunc.org. Support for the state of things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'm Frank Stachow.